All right, all right. So, this is the show. Should be a good one for you today. We got Ambassador Jack Matlock coming on the show. Who's Ambassador Jack Matlock? I'm pretty sure he was the last ambassador to the USSR. He's written a couple of good things lately, the most recent of which is in the Washington Post today about America's stance in Eastern Europe and how that has provoked the Russians into their what looks like what's going to be annexation. Re-annexation of the Crimean Peninsula. So, yeah, he's got some interesting things to say. I'm going to give him a chance to talk to you guys about all that. And then also, we're going to be talking with this guy, Nicholas J.S. Davies. Davies. You know, one time the state of Texas got themselves convinced that my name was Davies. I think they thought my first name was Davies. I was Davies Horton, they thought. Now, who the hell told them that? Or how they ever decided that that could possibly be true? I just don't know. What I should have done was racked up a bunch of debts in Davies Horton's name, I guess. I've never heard of anybody having that for a first name before. Well, the state of Texas, the computer, has me, it thinks. Anyway, I think I finally got them to fix all that. Hope I didn't just give an identity thief a backdoor into my life now. But I have that whole blood turnip thing going on, so I'm not too worried about it. All right. Well, anyway. Yeah, you can steal my identity and then try to apply for a bunch of stuff on credit and get turned down. Some adventure and identity theft you would have there. All right. Well, yeah. I'm a waste of time. Go target somebody else. Thank you. I didn't say why Nicholas J.S. Davies was going to be on the show. Why is because he's written this article. It's hardly, what's the word I'm looking for here? Sorry, I'm not very good at talking on Monday mornings, apparently. That'll be my excuse for now, anyway. It's not comprehensive. Thank you, Vocabulary, for coming up with comprehensive for me. I appreciate that. It's not comprehensive. It's just a small segment, admittedly, but it's a list of 35 countries where the U.S. has supported fascists, drug lords, and terrorists. You know, not like them stinky old Russians who, you know, would go so far as to intervene in somebody else's country where they have no business. Yeah. 35. It's a partial list. But it'll suffice. Nicholas J.S. Davies will be on the show with his list of as many as he can get to. 35 countries where America's propped up fascist, torture, dictator, murderers. Okay, and then Gareth Porter the Great will be on for part two. That's right, part two in a series. I don't know how many it's going to take. As many as it takes. I am interviewing Gareth Porter about his book, Manufactured Crisis in Pieces. And the first part was for the KPFK show that played yesterday, Sunday morning, on KPFK in Los Angeles. You can find it at their website, kpfk.org. And or sooner or later, let's see, it will be up on my own site. Maybe it already is. Let me look. Oops. To the front page here at scotthorton.org. And no, it's not up yet, but it will be. And anyway, so what happened was Gareth the Great, he wrote this book. It's called Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. Not quite untold because he's been writing about it and I've been interviewing him about it all these times, all these years. But here's the thing of it, though, is, man, I'm learning all kinds of great stuff in this thing. So we pretty much covered the intro, chapter one, chapter two, in the first interview. Again, that will be in the archives at scotthorton.org. You can also find it at kpfk.org on the archives for Sunday morning. Anti-War Radio is the show. But so today, that'll be part two. And then I'm just going to keep interviewing him about each section of the book, if not each and every chapter separately. But anyway, I'm going to keep interviewing him till we get all the way through it. And then we'll have, you know, the MP3 form of Gareth's book, sort of, kind of. The Scott Horton interview version of Manufactured Crisis by Gareth the Great. By the way, even if you're illiterate and you just like listening to Gareth on the show, it's probably the right thing to buy his book. Don't you think? Supply and demand and all that. Give it to somebody else. Donate it to the local library or something, you know? Maybe, you know, like my buddy, maybe you love to read, but it hurts your eyes so much you just can't anymore. Well, that's all right. So buy the book and then give it to the library. Or give it to, you know, a private institution if you're not into communism and stuff. Okay. So there's that. Matlock, Davies, and Porter on the show today. Boy, did that take me a long time to say. And now I've hardly got any time at all. Well, I know what I'll do. I'll talk about this first, and then I'll talk about those things later. Yeah, that's what I'll do. I just wanted to mention secession. Did you hear the Pat Buchanan interview? In fact, if you heard the Pat Buchanan interview 2 weeks ago or a week and a half ago or whatever it was, you probably didn't hear the end of it if you heard it here on Liberty Express, because we went over time. The show ended at the top of the hour, and then that was the end of that. But the whole thing is available there on antiwar.com. And I like to believe that America is immune from this kind of thing. We ought to be, should be, could be, if we did it right. Could be more immune anyway than most of the rest of the world. But in the rest of the world, I think Pat Buchanan is right, that the future is the forces of right-wing reaction. And that's all over the place. And so, you know, where the rubber meets the road, mostly that means, you know, ethnic and religious tribalism. And it's always been the order of the day on the planet Earth. And to the degree to which the neocons and their whole end of history type of, you know, New World Order, America and England's way and all of that kind of thing was ever going to last, I think it's pretty clear it's over now. If they ever had their opportunity, you know, if they had been libertarians and not neoliberals, they had been libertarians, they had been Harry Browns up there giving heroic speeches since the end of the Cold War about the benefits of religious reform and moderation and free markets and individual liberty and property rights and the Statue of Liberty and all that great stuff like Harry Brown used to always talk about. Or, you know, if Ron Paul had been elected in 1988, for example, when he first ran, and it had been a libertarian in charge at the end of the Cold War. I think that free markets and democracy, as the Clintonians call their empire, I think the actual free markets and democracy, very, very vaguely defined libertarianism, self-government and some capitalism and property rights compared to typical old world forms, I think that would be those ideas, those ways of doing things, those values and customs would be spreading across the world like wildfire in a much more powerful way now. And I think that the forces of right-wing reaction and, you know, medieval ignorance and killing people over belonging to the other sect and all of that kind of stuff would be much more in abeyance. And you know what? There is no march of history, right? Like the commies say about, oh, the page is turning and the wind of time is blowing and all that. That's not how the world works. A lot of bad things can happen, a lot of good things and a lot of contradictory things, and you never know in any given moment which way life on planet Earth is going to go. But I can tell you this for sure, that spending a generation since the end of the Cold War butchering people, through outright invasions and bombings, starving them through blockades, and gangsterizing the hell out of their economies and their resources through the IMF and the World Bank and all these things, has sold liberty to the people of the world as nothing but a corrupt, corrupt jargon of the blood-soaked hypocrites of the American Empire. And nobody takes those kinds of principles. If Harry Brown was here and gave his best Statue of Liberty speech right now, the whole world would just roll their eyes, and they would never even believe him after what America's done. You blew it. Oh, man, I'm late. Sure hope I can make my flight.
Stand there.
Me? I am standing here.
Come here.
Okay.
Hands up, turn around.
Whoa, easy.
Into the scanner. Ooh, what's this in your pants?
Hey, slow down. It's just my...
Hold it right there. Your wallet has tripped the metal detector. What's this? The Bill of Rights?
That's right. It's just a harmless stainless steel business card-sized copy of the Bill of Rights from SecurityEdition.com. They're for exposing the TSA as a bunch of liberty-destroying goons who've never protected anyone from anything. Sir, now give me back my wallet and get out of my way. Got a plane to catch.
Have a nice day.
Play a leading role in the security theater with the Bill of Rights Security Edition from SecurityEdition.com. It's the size of a business card, so it fits right in your wallet, and it's guaranteed to trip the metal detectors wherever the police state goes. That's SecurityEdition.com. And don't forget their great Fourth Amendment socks.
Hey, guys, I got his laptop.
Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. Yeah, so right now we have, one example, obviously, of apparently a very popular secession going on is the Crimean Peninsula attempting to leave their political union with Ukraine and join the Russian Federation. We'll see how that goes, and we'll be talking about that in depth with Ambassador Jack Matlock here in just a few minutes. But this kind of thing is going on all over the world, and I'm not saying I'm against it. I'm for secession down to the last man. As Sheldon Richmond and I were talking, and he was saying that he's for the Articles of Confederation, which includes no power to tax and no real power of the so-called national government to compel anybody to do anything. But he's okay, even though he's an individualist anarchist, he's okay with that, just as long as the states are only bound and the people within the states are also only bound by Articles of Confederation, say between the townships and the counties. And the states will have no power to tax or enforce it either. Oh, and by the way, those townships and those counties, they all should have to be under the Articles of Confederation too, with no power to tax or enforce it. And these should all just be voluntary organizations and, 7 billion nation states on the planet Earth, hopefully at more peace. That's certainly what I want. But I don't think that, there's a lot of different ways to read progress and which way things are going. It seems to me like what's happening now in the different secessions around the world aren't so much, a bunch of Rothbardians deciding that they want, smaller political units for, just idealistic reasons. It's mostly because they're simply minorities being oppressed by the majority. Like Will Grigg is always quoting Vladimir Lenin, where the only question of power is who is doing what to whom and all of that kind of thing. And so the Flemish want to secede from the political union of Belgium. I mean, you look at Belgium on the map, it's this tiny little thing, and you go, oh yeah, I guess I've heard of the Flemish before. Yeah, well, the Flemish nation is dominated by the Belgians, and they're sick of it. And they think that they got to pay way too many taxes for the other guys who don't work hard enough or whatever it is. Same kind of fight is going on. It's in the news right now. You can find the link on antiwar.com, where Venice in Italy wants to secede from the rest of Italy and their political union. Because, the way they see it is they're the snooty northerners who get things done. And down there in the south, everybody's lazy and corrupt and living off of them. And they feel like they're being oppressed. They're being forced to pay for other people. Whether it's the central state or lazy welfare collectors or rich welfare collectors or whoever it is that they're angry at, still, they're just, it's resentment. And I guess my point is that, you know, never mind private property anarchy and all this idealistic stuff for a minute. Even if you're just a Jacob Hornbergerian about it and you want extremely limited minarchist constitutional Republican type form of government, if the law only reaches so far as the power of the state to protect your natural property rights from forced theft and fraud and, you know, prosecute crimes and provide courts for civil suits under common law and blah, 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 very basic kind of governance that people, you know, the kind that they teach us we have, the kind that, you know, people like to believe in. If if it was really impartial, if it really wasn't all about race and all about religion and all about tribe and all about whose ancestors fought whose ancestors over which peninsula whenever it was, then there's really no reason for the Flemish to want to break off from the Belgians or for the Venetians to want to break off. I mean, they can't go anywhere, right? I mean, they're still part of Italy, but they want to leave that political union. It's the same thing all over the world. And Catalonia and, of course, the Basques have, for a long time, there's been a fight for separatism among the Basques in Spain and now Catalonia as well. And then just think about what we all already know about how in Asia, especially, you know, all the stands and all that kind of thing, you know, between Persia or north of Persia, between Turkey and China, all those borders were drawn by whites from Europe back in the days of colonialism. The same thing for Africa. So if you have a total state, or at least, you know, not necessarily a totalitarian state, but you have an authoritarian state where it's all about who does what to whom, even if it's a democracy, it's just majority rule oppression, then what you have is all over the world. You have people, quote unquote, stuck on the wrong side of the lines, separate from their ethnic kin, this and that. Now, in a Wilsonian world, every ethnic group would have their own nation state like that. Except we've already lived through the history of mankind, including the age of exploration and the age of empire and conquest, and you have people mixed up all over the world. Now, in America, like I said, we ought to be exempt from all of this because we have liberty here. We have such a limited government and such a free society that, for example, the white majority, why, we're not worried at all what might happen if the whites were no longer the majority anymore, because after all, it's just a limited constitutional republic where the government only has the power to protect all of our rights, right, everybody? So we're not too worried about that. Isn't that the way all the ethnic minorities in America see it too? Sorry, guys. I'm talking about the ideal here. I do think, hey, I lived in L.A. for a while, man, and I would go around and I would see everybody from all over the world, first-generation immigrants and second-generation immigrants from all over the world, every kind of language you could imagine. You didn't even think, wow, there's actually a little Sao Paulo over off Venice Boulevard, you know, like they actually have, you know, Portuguese town for the Brazilian immigrants to L.A. and whatever. And everybody has their own little nation-state neighborhood, and everybody gets along fine for the most part. They all more or less speak English, and they all more or less use phony Federal Reserve currency and get along just fine, day in and day out, you know, except for the state, of course, preying on the poor and the weak, and the darker you are, the more they target you, but you know, other than that, everybody seems to get on fine because they're mostly free. I'd like to think the rest of the world could be that way. I'd like to spread libertarianism to the whole wide world as soon as I'm done spreading it to the Americans. I'd like to see the whole world live, you know, with the same precepts of natural individual liberty that I've got and that I would like to see my society based on. But the number one worst way to accomplish that is to do what the American Empire has done. Kill people and call it democracy and freedom and liberty and self-government. And so what's the reaction to that? You know, look at in Eastern Europe, man, I saw a poll, and this has been a few years ago, but there was a poll in Eastern Europe where people are missing the USSR. And we're talking in Eastern Europe, not in Russia, where, you know, they were the seat of power in the USSR, but we're talking about in the Eastern European satellite states that were dominated by the USSR. They miss it. Compared to capitalism? Are you kidding me? How could that be? But, of course, the answer is militarism. And, of course, the answer is the corruption of the American Empire in their society, and most to the point, the boom and bust, the repeated booms and busts of America's fiat money system, the policy of unlimited money printing, and the unsustainable boom that occasionally, you know, every 6 or 8 or 10 years completely implodes. Takes everything everybody ever worked for their whole life and evaporates it into the ether. Boy, people hate that. How could they possibly miss the USSR? Because what the American Empire, what our, you know, it's not, I was going to say kind of soft fascism, but sure as hell ain't soft if you're on the receiving end of it. I mean, we do have regular elections and everything. I know that. They haven't outright overthrown the Constitution, but it's a pretty fascist empire if you're on the receiving end of it, going around calling itself libertarianism, right? Basically, Bill Clinton is, you know, was, and George W. Bush and Barack Obama since, although Obama talks this way to a little bit lesser of a degree, but not that much. He does talk this way, too. They basically crib from Harry Brown, but they just bastardize it. You know, it's their Statue of Liberty speech. Oh, yeah, all America cares about is freedom and liberty. And that's why we denounce Russia running off with Crimea, even though everybody knows that it was an American coup. And that the American coup provoked the Russians into going ahead and protecting their interests, just the way America would, to a much less degree than America would. Boy, if Russia was pulling this kind of thing in Canada, we'd be at nuclear war with them. Everybody knows that. They're playing it real cool compared to what America could do. But, you know, when John Kerry says, hey, you don't just invade countries in the 21st century. What is this, the 19th century? Can't even go back to the bloodiest century ever, the last one. He's got to go back to the 19th somehow. But everybody in the whole world knows that John Kerry supported that war. That John Kerry could have stopped the war in Iraq if he had decided he was going to war in the U.S. Senate to prevent it. He could have told the truth about Iraq. He could have told the truth that really Saddam's probably our best ally in the war against Al-Qaeda, if you consider Al-Qaeda the actual enemy, instead of the people you got an old grudge against. Everybody knows that. Everybody's laughing in his face. And everybody thinks, and boy, it ain't just at Salon.com, it's all over the place. People think capitalism means the U.S. government holding a gun to somebody's head. And then, of course, so what do they think is the opposite of that? Their own government being even more powerful, hopefully powerful enough to keep the U.S. government out somehow or something. Yeah, if only we have even more government control over our economies, and that'll help protect us from the Americans, they think. So much for spreading freedom. So much for the end of history. And then, of course, the very worst part of it all is the renewed rise of Al-Qaeda. Because, of course, the Americans just used this small group of terrorists as a brand name for basically their pretend enemy as they went around, you know, picking fights with their old grudges. And look what they did. Where George Bush, he did the most to benefit the Al-Qaeda movement, the greater Sunni jihadi movement in the Middle East than anyone could have ever dreamed. Michael Scheuer called his invasion of Iraq the hoped for but unexpected gift to bin Laden. That's Scheuer, the former chief of the CIA's bin Laden unit. And of course, we all know that Bush turned the Sunni provinces of Iraq into a lawless terrorist training ground this whole time. And then Obama has even helped to expand those wars to Libya, to Syria, and beyond. And you can read Patrick Coburn all about it. He's got a 5-part series coming out all about it. He talked about it on the show last week. That's the ultimate expression of this reaction that I'm talking about, and it's coming for our ass still. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org, nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. Offnow.org. Well, isn't that a hell of a thing? I can't reach the ambassador. Maybe he's on the other line with an important interview or something like that, and I'll try him again in a few minutes. How about that? Should be okay. We'll try him back in just a little while. I think it's really important. I'm kind of glad I have the time to elaborate on what I was just getting to there about Patrick Cockburn's new piece. And we talked about this on the show with Patrick last week, from the London Independent. And it's about, I was kind of cracking wise, I guess, about, you have these good jihadists and the bad jihadists. Which ones America's backing in Syria? What is the difference between the Free Syrian Army and the Islamic Front and Jabhat al-Nusra and the Islamic State of Iraq and the Sham? And he's saying, yeah, like he just starts laughing. Like, it's all the same thing. These guys all want the same thing. They're all basically bin Ladenites. And now the thing is, this is the guy who, Patrick Cockburn, he's the same guy who would have told you back in the earlier days of the Iraq War, at least, that, well, these guys really aren't al-Qaeda guys. These are the Sunni-based insurgency in Iraq, and they're basically the tribal leaders, and they're being frozen out. They're losing political power big time, and that's what they're fighting for. And it was, the al-Qaeda movement only slowly grew up, never really did take over the Sunni-based insurgency in Iraq, but certainly had thousands and thousands of young men went to Iraq to fight and then go back home again. Most of them went and got jobs, but many did not. And, what's going on right now is simply the spread of that. So when they went home to Libya, they started building up their forces in the east, centered around Benghazi, in that area, and many of them have gone home to Syria as well, and the ones who've gone home to Saudi Arabia, Prince Bandar sent them off to Syria. Don't come home here, go to Syria. A lot of them, they can't go home to, Jordan, perhaps if they're from Jordan, so they stayed in Iraq. And even though they were marginalized by the Sunni tribes in 2006 and 2007, they never completely went away. And then as soon as the regime change operation started in Syria 3 years ago by the Saudis and the Americans and the Turks, they crossed the border. We gave them something else to do. We gave them another few hundred miles to the west of where they'd ever been before. Direct access to the sea, in fact. I mean, I don't know if they control the coast, but presumably some of them. And then, this whole thing, it's just like Michael Scheuer described Iraq as could have been the cork in the bottle. I mean, really, Iran too. If they in the Bush administration listened to Flint and Hillary Leverett, when they were negotiating with Iran and Iran was helping America against the Taliban and against al-Qaeda, we could have worked with Iraq and Iran to keep the al-Qaeda guys isolated in Afghanistan. There were only a few dozen of them survived the war of the fall of 01. They were banished to the ass end of the planet Earth. The Afghan-Pakistan border, the Durrán line that the British drew back when? Pashtunistan. They talk about Afghanistan like it's the ultimate perfect secret hideout to attack America from there. But that's not true at all, right? They had to hire some Egyptian grad students going to college in Germany in order to get into our country to attack us. And then in that case, they had to hijack American planes in order to have something to crash into something else. There ain't a damn thing accessible about America from Afghanistan or any of our allies in Western Europe either, or Eastern Europe, where all of our allies also live, you know, more of them. But now, what's America done? American policy. George W. Bush, I think, sort of by accident, but I don't mean to acquit him. I think it was because of abject stupidity and imperial hubris and arrogance that led them to think that they could control all the events on the ground in Afghanistan. What are you calling the army a wimp? The army's really tough and can beat you up. And so, therefore, don't worry. Whatever happens in Iraq is going to be fine. They can take care of it. And anyway, so that's helped lead to this. And then Barack Obama, and I've told you this before, and it's still my conclusion. I know the Saudis hated Gaddafi, and that's part of it and everything. But I think the primary reason that America did the regime change in Libya 3 years ago was because of bad public relations from the Arab Spring in Tunisia and Egypt, especially in Egypt, where, again, with these forces of reaction and disgust from one American war and support for torture and murder across Arab lands in the Middle East and including in occupied Palestine indefinitely, as always, you know, and support for the dictators, and also debasing the money supply. America's got the global reserve currency, which means that when Ben Bernanke debases the currency, or Alan Greenspan before him, the rest of the world has to also inflate in order to not throw off their very delicately achieved trade balances, etc. And so what happens is people who are really poor become that much poorer. Somebody living on $2 a day, their dollar's only worth 50 cents now. And they can't afford to feed their people. And then they riot. And that's what really, you know, precipitated the Arab Spring, was people are hungry and pissed off. And they were radicalized by the war. They resented Mubarak that much more for being the stooge of the Americans who had just overseen this, well, and quite participated in the slaughter in Iraq. And they overthrew his sorry ass. And Hillary Clinton said, uh-oh, this is bad public relations because it's becoming too obvious, even to the American people, that the USA backs every dictator in the region. Every single one of them, other than Assad and the Ayatollah Khomeini. Although they did hire Assad to torture people to death for them from time to time. Well, quite often, actually, in the Clinton and Bush Jr. years. He still wasn't their exact sock puppet. But anyway, so they said, wow, the American people are beginning to understand that Uncle Sam is the bad guy. America is the evil empire. And if there's a sultan cutting some guy's head off for no good reason anywhere in the Middle East right now, he's doing it with a pocket full of American tax dollars. Oops. You know what we should do? We should overthrow Gaddafi. He's expendable. And that'll be a great PR stunt to pretend that we're on the side of the little guy. Just like that time we invaded France to liberate them from the Nazis. And it worked, by the way. It at least confused the issue as to who's wearing the black hat and who's wearing the white hat in the Middle East. Every black hat is supported by the ultimate black hat. The 10 zillion ton gorilla, the U.S. Empire. But it did confuse the issue. And people thought, oh yeah, look here, we're supporting the revolution. And then they pulled the same script in Syria, or they try, they haven't won yet. And they didn't get their no-fly zone and bombing campaign and all of that this time. But they pulled the same scam about, oh, look, it's the people versus the dictator. And never mind who backs which dictator, right? And so they decided they would exploit the Arab Spring in Syria in order to turn that into a regime change. And what's funny is, you know, they may have gotten away with getting a hell of a lot of concessions, if not an outright, you know, change of regime, if they had just let things alone there. But it was so obvious from the very beginning to everybody backing Assad that it was the Americans and the Turks and the Saudis and the Qataris who were sending a bunch of suicide bomber jihadis, a lot of them left over from the last Iraq war, to come and suicide bomb their schools full of women and children and cut their heads off for believing the wrong religion, and they reacted quickly. And I'm not, in fact, you know what, there's a lot of chicken and the egg in there. I'm sure Assad's initial crackdowns on the protests were out of line as well. But still, the reason that everybody has rallied around Assad, that has rallied around Assad, is because they know that his dictatorship is what's preventing their head from being cut off of their shoulders for being a Shiite or an Alawite or a Christian or whatever it is when the ISIS comes to town. So, nice foreign policy, America, as Patrick Coburn. And you know, Patrick Coburn's first piece here, it's at The Independent and at UNS.com. Al-Qaeda, the second act, while the global war on terror went wrong. It reminds me of Loretta Napoleone's book from 10 years ago almost now, where she talked about al-Zarqawi and the new generation. I guess it was 9 years ago, right? 2005. Al-Zarqawi and the new generation. You know, all the jihadis that were fighting in the Iraq war, they were young kids. They weren't the veterans of the Afghan war supported by Ronald Reagan. They were their sons. The only guys, the only involvement of the old Mujahideen was in organizing the pilgrimages. They were a whole new generation. Saudi and Israeli studies in 2005 came to that same conclusion. You might read it in the Christian Science Monitor about how it was virtually 99.999% young, angry young men who came of age long after the CIA, Pakistani, Saudi, Mujahideen war in Afghanistan against the Soviet Union in the 1980s. A whole new generation grew up, and now, so here they are, Act 2. I guess this is really Act 3, you know? Why the global war on terror went wrong. And of course the answer is, I know I go on and on sometimes. The bottom line here is, what went wrong was that the U.S. decided, great, we have an Emmanuel Goldstein character in the form of this Bin Laden guy, and now we can go blow up whatever we want. We can go do whatever we want. And it's an enemy that they never did take really seriously, even after they killed 3,000 people in this country. Because, I mean, what are we talking about? A band of pirates. We're talking about a bunch of losers who have no power to tax, who have no air force of their own, no explosives of their own, no nothing. And, you know, you can sit at an office in Washington, D.C. and seize all their bank accounts. And so, anyway, come on, let's go find some real enemies. As long as we got the American people angry at the red flag, let's go to Iraq. And then, of course, they wanted to go to Syria, Iran, and the rest, but, of course, the Iraq war went so horrible from the very get-go that they were unable to do that. But, yeah, old Patrick Coburn, he's telling a sad story, and I'm afraid that, it's already true, right? We can all just shrug and shake our head that this new generation of Al-Qaeda will continue to serve as excuses for more intervention from here on out, not proof that we've got to finally knock it off. And so it goes, as Kurt Vonnegut would say. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who provides his subscribers with a very real window into his investments, updating them on every move he makes in the markets. Right now, Mike's anticipating a bear and is dumping all the stocks while the getting is good, investing instead in gold and the commodities. Protect your assets and learn the wise ways of the markets. WallStreetWindow.com. And check out Mike Swanson's great contribution to the history of the rise of the American Empire and the war state. Available at ScottHorton.org/Amazon. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, well, I don't know if the dude's ringer's off or what. He's emailing me saying, oh, well, you haven't called yet, even though I've called 10 times, so. That's all right. He's an old guy, man. These things happen. Maybe I'll interview him tomorrow or something. All right, well, anyway. All he was going to say is what you already know. America picked this fight. The Russians are the helpless victims here, and America is the evil empire. Boo-hoo for your retarded emotions, if that hurts your feelings so bad to hear it. But how could America be the evil empire? I'm from here. Well, how about this? Barack Obama's the president, and he's evil, right? Okay. Or maybe you're a liberal and you just love Barack Obama no matter who he murders to death. How about this? George W. Bush used to be the emperor, and this is the result of his policy. There. I'm so sick of this crap about... It's so funny, especially on Twitter, to watch... You know, mostly who I follow on Twitter are, you know, media people, right? It's not the people who are following... On Facebook, I'm more like interacting with... You know, those on my level, right? On Twitter, mostly following media people. And the things that they think and tell each other and the unproven assertions and assumptions that they reinforce to each other all day. It's just hilarious to watch. Never mind every other fact that you know in your brain. America's the good guy. Superman, red, white, and blue, loves the tiny little people of Crimea and just can't stand to see them oppressed by the Russians. Yeah, okay. And so now, among the American population, who believes that? Do conservatives even believe that? I don't think so. I mean, you look at the poll numbers of who wants to do anything about it. It's basically the population of Washington, D.C. Nobody else in America is for doing anything about it. And now maybe the, you know, some right-wingers latch onto this thing about if only Obama was a tougher guy, Putin wouldn't have tried it in the first place. But that doesn't really make any sense, does it? Since Putin knows that Obama, no matter how bad he bombed Syria, could never do anything as far as having a war with Russia. Since, you know, H-bombs and mutually assured destruction and all that is still in play. So what difference does it make how bad he bombed Benghazi after liberating it? Or how bad he bombed Syria if he'd bombed Syria like he wanted to do last fall? Doesn't make any sense. The right answer, the one and only correct answer, is that Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, well, for that matter, George H.W. Bush, but especially Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama, all three are right-wing nationalist fascist imperialists who are determined on what they call benevolent global hegemony, full-spectrum dominance, military supremacy over the entire planet Earth, including Russia. And what we're going to do, as our would-be guest today has said, as Paul Pillar has written at the National Interest, as is the consensus among honest and thinking people everywhere writing about this, it's America that's the bully. It's America that's been kicking the Russians since they're, you know, while they're down, since the end of the Cold War and the fall of the Soviet Union. And from the Russian point of view, if any honest person puts themselves in the point of view of the leadership of the Russian state, American encroachment on their so-called doorstep or backyard or whatever, right? On their front porch or whichever analogy you want to use. These are all cribbed from the media in the last week I've been reading, right? They're very, very, very near abroad. America's encroachment has gone too far. And when in the Bush years, when they talked about bringing Ukraine and Georgia into NATO, the Russians made it clear that, no, you're not going to do that. And, you know, really, the Russians played it cool when America launched the Orange Revolution coup d'etat in 2004. They sat back and waited after the American coup, Orange Revolution in 2004, and their guy won the election in 2010. Again. And then the Americans overthrew him again. And where's that audio come from? Is that from the TV? You guys hearing that? Am I breaking up and going in the red? Where the hell's that coming from? Well, I hope the NSA isn't broadcasting things directly into my Frankenstein brain thoughts. That could be problematic for later. No, sorry. Some kind of feedback. I think it's from the TV. I think there's a problem with the TV audio out that makes it kind of screwy. Maybe I'll hit mute on the TV even though it's not playing out over its channel. And maybe that will help. All right, anyway. The Americans have picked this fight. It's as simple as that. They overthrew the government in Kiev. And then the new nationalist government, Ukrainian nationalist government that they put in power, turned right around and passed a language law. Taking away Russian as an official second language, which was considered obviously a severe affront to the, so-called ethnic Russian. I don't think there's really an ethnic difference between East and West, not the way they say it. Sort of a national difference. I don't know. Aren't they Slavs in the West too? Anyway, I should ask my wife at the break. She knows. They picked this fight. It's no different than if the Russians were screwing around in Mexico and in Canada. In fact, look at how Ronald Reagan behaved when the Soviets had the slightest thing to do with the Marxist movements in El Salvador and Nicaragua. He hired death squads to hack them to death with machetes. You know, the ones who were lucky. And, could have started a war over that. If Vladimir Putin had an American foreign policy in Canada right now, we would be at war. And for the American media, it's funny to even read Leslie Gelb, who's the president for many years of the Council on Foreign Relations. He actually helped write the Pentagon Papers with Daniel Ellsberg before Daniel Ellsberg liberated them. And this is a celebrated establishment guy. He's just slightly the left, he's the Democrat Richard Haass. He wrote a thing for the Daily Beast. Paul Pillar, the former head of the National Intelligence Council, has been writing like this, too. Even Henry Kissinger has been writing, not just saying we should stop acting the way we're acting, but saying that we're lying. The entire position of the American side is fake here. And how in the hell are we going to make any progress when we're basing our actual policies off of our false narratives? And when we have our Secretary of State mouthing off in a way where our guys never talk like that about the Soviets. Or, not the actual Secretary of State didn't go directly, personally insulting them in this kind of way, the way that John Kerry's doing. And so, I think it's important to note that while you see this never-ending parade of, basically lie by omission on TV, that the truth is not omitted completely, not online anyway. Again, the Daily Beast, the Washington Post, the National Interest. This isn't alternative media, it's just online media. Nothing revolutionary about it. I mean, hell, the Washington Post, that's the newspaper. I think they might even publish the former ambassador today. And shouldn't that be, maybe that is the most important headline out of all of this. That in the midst of a border dispute between the American Empire and Russia, 6,000 miles east of here, or wherever the hell it is, that the entire media narrative in America is basically Soviet-level deception and distortion and lie by omission. That here our government is getting us into a fight in a limited fashion so far, but maybe renewing a real Cold War with Russia over lies and nonsense and provocations from our side without even hardly the slightest honest assessment of cause and effect, or as these critics I'm citing keep pushing it, Russia's legitimate point of view and national interest involved here. It's madness what they're doing. It's just completely reckless. And you know what it is? It's like a whole government of John McCain's. And what's John McCain worried about? Feeling tough today. and feeling like he looked tough today. For his own gain, for his own reasons, for his own weaknesses. And that's the same as all of them. You know, it's people like you and me who have no real dog in the fight other than we don't want to die in a nuclear war, but we're not, you know, or whatever our interests are more general and removed, who can be honest about this, who can even really entertain the questions. Like, yeah, but then what? Remember General Mattis, when they're talking about Iran and what to do about Iran, he kept saying, but then what? But then what? And that was why they fired him. It wasn't that he was trying to say, what'll happen if you don't bomb him? He was saying, what if you do? What if you give them an ultimatum and they don't obey? And they just got rid of him. They don't want to hear talk like that. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I guess I forgot to mention that my website is scotthorton.org, and my chat room is at scotthorton.org/chat, if you like chat rooms. Also, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /ScottHortonShow. /ScottHortonShow. All right, and, scotthorton.org. I keep all my interview archives there. My whole show archives, too, but the interview archives, there's about 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003. So, if you like listening to stuff, I got plenty of stuff. All right. First guest on the show today is Nicholas J.S. Davies. He writes for Alternet, and I apologize to him and you that I don't have a complete bio here. But anyway, welcome to the show. Nicholas, how are you doing?
Yeah, hi, Scott. Yep, doing all right here amidst all the chaos that our country's creating around the world. But I'm sitting here in Miami. It's a nice day, and, you know, all's right in my little corner here.
Oh, that's good. They haven't gotten you nuked off the face of the earth yet. We'll take that as a blessing. Well, good. I'm happy that we're all still alive. We can do a radio show. So, I really like this piece. I like when anybody will take the time to go through and make a catalog like this. This is the sort of article that can kind of live forever, even sort of maybe in pamphlet form or something, and I bet will. It's the kind of thing that... you know, a high school student on a bus somewhere, or, you know, any housewife visiting a doctor's office, or anybody can just pick this thing up and start looking at it. 35 countries where the U.S. has supported fascists, drug lords, and terrorists. And I already know that you're right about this stuff, so go ahead and go down the list, A to Z here, as much as we can fit in half an hour.
Yeah, well, I don't know where, you know, we started Afghanistan, you know, and I think, you know, Afghanistan should be a lesson to all of us and to our policymakers of where this leads. They had a socialist government that had, you know, evolved over, you know, many years since they really achieved complete independence from Britain back in 1919, and successive governments in Afghanistan were trying to improve the lives of their people. You know, they had a government that was doing more than any previous one for women's rights and education and very critically land reform. And of course, that was where a lot of the established tribal leaders and rural landowners were very unhappy with the government, and so the U.S. and its allies exploited that to back, you know, the most conservative, socially regressive forces in the country, and ultimately overthrow the government.
Doesn't even necessarily have to concede to the graciousness or the benevolence of the government in Kabul to recognize that, at least according to the Americans, like Zbigniew Brzezinski, they brag, Robert Gates, too, in his book, they brag that they didn't just react to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan by bankrolling the Mujahideen. They started backing the Mujahideen in order to provoke the Soviets into invading in a war that ended up costing millions of Afghan lives. Approximately 2 million people died during that thing. And then, of course, you know, all of the blowback and reaction that we know has come since then, up to and including and through the American invasion and occupation that's now lasted more than a dozen years.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, this is where, and you know, the title talks about fascists, drug lords, and terrorists. You know, in Afghanistan, we are talking drug lords and terrorists. You know, the people who we have consistently backed and put into power there, you know, turned the country into, you know, a narco state. You know, in my article, I talk about the actual production of heroin, of opium and heroin from that country. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, previously, you know, you were talking maybe, you know, tens or hundreds of tons. You know, once these guys seized power in the 1990s, you know, there was just a tenfold increase in production of opium, to where it fluctuated between 2,000 and 3,500 tons per year. But since the U.S. invaded in 2001, since 2004, for the last 10 years, the country has produced more than 5,000 tons of opium per year. And, you know, this is what our government has done in Afghanistan, you know. And
I thought it was great the way you linked
to
this New York Times story about how Hamid Karzai, the sock puppet so-called president there, his brother is a well-known CIA-backed drug lord. And that was the article where it was so obvious at the time that it was the CIA that put the article in the New York Times in the first place, because they were trying to discredit Karzai in favor of Abdullah Abdullah, which didn't work. But they were trying to regime change him back in 2009. And so they leaked this story about how Karzai's got no credibility because he's a heroin dealer backed by us.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, and then when you come to terrorism, well, you know, here we are. If we ever needed an object lesson in the kind of trouble this can cause when we back these kind of people and arm them and train them, you know, here we have, you know, the very roots of Al-Qaeda. And, you know, this is, and yet here we are, you know, what, 20, 30 years later, just going down the same road, Libya, Syria.
We've got a deal, you know, to stay in Afghanistan until 2024. Never even mind the rest of them. All right, now, and speaking of the rest of them, we got about 2.5-3 minutes here before we got to go out to our break. And so I guess instead of doing alphabetical order, it makes sense for the article, but let's go, you decide whether you want to go, if you want to divide up the nations by, for example, geography, Latin American interventions or African ones, or whether you want to talk about, you know, chronologically, 50s and 60s interventions versus 70s and 80s ones, or however you want to break it up. I want to give you a chance to really kind of go down the list and shock people a little bit at just the quantity and the amount, the endless reach of the American intelligence and military agencies in regime changing other people's countries around the world. I mean, for someone who doesn't already know this stuff, it ought to blow their mind, you know?
Yeah, well, it really should do, because it's sure not the way the U.S. Likes to present itself. You know, I think I could start by, you know, if I would urge people to read the article, but secondly, if they want to see more of this stuff, more of this big picture, there's a book I would recommend by William Bloom, that's B-L-U-M, and the title is Killing Hope. And this really documents, you know, on a broader scale, just all U.S. military and CIA interventions in countries around the world since 1945.
And he's a former State Department official, correct?
I'm sorry, yes, he worked in the State Department in the 60s, yeah, and became pretty swiftly disillusioned. But he, you know, I would say that, you know, I think what's in the comment, the most common comment I got reading the comments to this article on Ultinet were not, oh my God, 35 countries. It was more like people going, hey, how about this country you didn't mention? And only 35, are you kidding?
Right.
So, I mean, yeah, anyone who has studied this stuff understands that this is, you know, as I said in the article, what it really represents in the big picture is, you know, this elusive but relentless quest for unchallenged global power, in which the U.S. has been completely unscrupulous in terms of who it is willing to work with to achieve goals that are, I think most of us would agree, are really unattainable. Mm-hmm. And so this is, you know, just an incredibly tragic history of what our country and our government has done with its unparalleled wealth and power mm-hmm. over the last century.
Well, you know, I mean, it's gone so far where people even think to refer to foreigners as humans whose lives and rights are worth considering at all is sort of some kind of pansy, lefty, liberal, hippie kind of a concept. Everybody knows that when it comes to state and state action, foreigners don't have rights except to lay down and die and or, you know, do what they're told if they know what's good for them. And that's about it. And you know, that's just the adult, reasonable, realist point of view about how the world works and what state action is. So it really doesn't matter about collateral damage or anything like that. That's where they came up with the name collateral damage in the first place. And it's something unique for Americans to actually consider foreigners as people at all. And I'm sorry we got to go this break. We'll be right back with Nicholas J.S. Davies in just a sec. On March 7th at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., the Council for the National Interest is co-hosting the first ever national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Confirmed speakers include Walt Scheuer, Giraldi, McGovern, Katowski, Porter, McConnell, Weiss, Raimondo, USS Liberty survivor Ernie Gallo, as well as co-sponsors Alison Ware of If Americans Knew and the great Grant Smith of the Institute for Research Middle East Policy. That's the National Summit to Reassess the U.S.-Israel Special Relationship, Friday, March the 7th, all day at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., natsummit.org. All right. Welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Nicholas J.S. Davies. He wrote this thing for Alternet. It's also at Salon.com. You might have seen it. Made the rounds. Went pretty viral last week. It's the era of the listicle, right? What can we say? 35 countries where the U.S. has supported fascists, drug lords, and terrorists. And then, I'm sorry we got interrupted by the break. I was sort of going on moralizing there about how ultimately Americans, all of us, and I don't know all of us, but Americans generally speaking of all different races have sort of this honorary white supremacy in a way or whatever it is, that if you're an American, it's just perfectly okay to kill the hell out of anybody. How could anybody justify nuking Hiroshima? And the answer is because Japanese are considered basically the same as ants. And in fact, Admiral Fallon, who stopped the war with Iran in 2007, later told, Vanity Fair magazine that, look, these people are ants. And when it comes to time to do so, we will crush them. He was the hero who stopped the war. And his point being that, you know, they're gooks. In fact, Noam Chomsky likes to quote Lloyd George as saying, well, we must reserve the right to kill. And then, you know, the N-word I wouldn't possibly repeat on the air here for you. And that really is the attitude, that as long as it's the government doing it, there is no limit to the amount of murder that they can commit, other than maybe the amount of American soldiers that get wounded in the process or something like that.
Yeah, and yet there's this incredible sort of propaganda system to convey the impression to Americans and to the world that, you know, that this is all well-intentioned and that, as President Obama has said, that the U.S. military is the greatest force for good in the world. And this is remarkably effective. And so, you know, I guess that's where I hope an article like this can help, because, you know, you have to sort of hold up this image that the U.S. presents of itself to the world, and then hold up what I'm writing about in this article on the other side and say, well, wait a minute, these can't both be true, you know. And, you know, hopefully this will encourage people to think about these things and do some more research of their own, and really recognize that, you know, we need substantial change in the way our government behaves in the world. You know, we're not talking about fine tuning here. We really need to turn over a new leaf if we are not going to just continue to spread violence and chaos across the world.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, everybody knows about the massive war to prop up the fascist dictatorship of South Korea, but for one example that you have on the list here, although people don't usually think of it in those terms, they know that that's true, that they didn't really start having regular elections until the late 1980s there. Which of these surprised you? Which of these were ones that you had heard the least about or maybe learned something new about? Fascist dictatorships here supported by the United States.
Well, I'll tell you, the last article I wrote for Alternet was basically about the failed war on terror. You know, I used the State Department's own statistics to show that, in fact, the result of the so-called war on terror has been a massive explosion of terrorism all over the world. And a guy called Larry Johnson, who worked really his whole career at the CIA and the State Department on these issues, read my article, and his response was pretty interesting, because he said that the main problem with respect to assessing the terrorist threat is to accurately define the state sponsorship. The biggest culprits today, in contrast to 20 years ago, are Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey. He also added that Iran is really not a state sponsor of terrorism to the extent that we are led to believe. But, you know, this was pretty interesting. You know, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, mm-hmm. and Turkey. And
yeah, in fact, Patrick Coburn has a brand new piece out just like that, too, the second act, Al-Qaeda, the second act, why the global war on terror went wrong. And that's exactly what he says, too.
Right. And, you know, and these are, again, you know, the three major U.S. allies. The U.S. in the past 10 years or so, the U.S. has given over $18 billion in military aid to Pakistan. I mean, some of which we know is being used through their ISI intelligence service, you know, to support the Taliban and the same people that our troops are fighting in Afghanistan. This is just this just seems like insanity. I think that's the way the Afghans look at it. They just think we are completely nuts to be essentially supporting both sides in a war in their country. You know, and then Saudi Arabia, the United States just closed the largest arms deal in history, $60 billion, you know, in F-15s and all kinds of other weaponry, you know, to one of the three largest state sponsors of terrorism in the world. And then, I mean, Turkey is pretty interesting because we don't hear so much about that. But in fact, it seems that as the Saudis are starting to be alarmed themselves by what they have unleashed in Syria, and they have even passed a law now, you know, with long prison sentences for Saudis who engage in terrorism and then come back to Saudi Arabia. Maybe that's just to deter them from coming back. But as the Saudis themselves seem to have scared themselves in what they've unleashed in Syria, you know, it seems like Turkey is still full steam ahead. You know, we don't seem to be seeing any let up in Turkish support for the Al-Qaeda related groups in who are demolishing Syria as we speak. And so, and of course, Turkey is, you know, an actual member of NATO. I mean, here we're, you know, we're debating whether Georgia and Ukraine should be members of NATO, or if that's part of the U.S. plan here, which the Russians seem to have managed to defuse. But Turkey is a longstanding member of NATO, and yet here they are, completely, you know, involved in a proxy war with U.S. support that has killed at least 100,000 people in Syria, turned millions of Syrians into refugees, wrecked entire neighborhoods and villages and towns, and it's still going on.
Right. And while America's backing so-called revolution against a military dictatorship in Syria, one that they don't control, they support the military dictators of Egypt. And, you know, I'm a libertarian, and I think it sounds like you're coming from the left somewhere, and it's pretty easy. I'm not putting words in your mouth, but it's pretty easy for people like us to refer to pretty much any military dictatorship as fascism. You know, certainly you look at Egypt as an economic system. Maybe they don't have, you know, all 14 points of fascism or whatever going on, but as an economic system and as a dictatorship, it sure seems pretty fascist if you're on the receiving end of it. But now tell me what you think, Nicholas, about what's going on in Ukraine, because I got pictures of the guys that America's backing, including John McCain's friend Tannenbaum with his Hitler salute up in the air. I got guys with SS lightning bolts and Iron Crosses running around in the Maidan, and apparently, what, at least 8 members of Right Sector and Svoboda have gotten high-level positions in the new government, including as head of the police, you know, the National Police Force here. This is the kind of thing where, you know, any kind of right-leaning groups anywhere else in Europe, you know, think of like Haider in Austria back 10, 15 years ago, whatever, when he had said some politically incorrect things about race. He was nothing. He wasn't parading around with SS lightning bolts and Hitler salutes, and they treated him like he was Hitler reborn. But in this case, they're outright backing these guys who are proud to be descendants of pro-Nazi forces.
Absolutely. I mean, they're putting up statues to the guy Bandera, who was sort of the head of the Ukrainian right-wing militia that worked with the Nazis. And, you know, in Germany, you'd go to jail for any of this stuff. But as you said, I am off the left. You know, the group I work with politically is the Progressive Democrats of America. Mm-hmm. And we put out an action alert to our members last week for them to contact the State Department and the White House and their members of Congress and demand 3 things. Number 1, the immediate resignation of Victoria Nuland and Jeffrey Pyatt. For anyone listening who does not know, these are the 2 U.S. officials who were caught on tape by the Russians discussing how they were going to replace the government, the elected government in the Ukraine.
Just so you know, we got 1 minute.
Okay. And so we're asking for their resignation. Victoria Nuland is married to Robert Kagan, the co-founder of the Project for the New American Century. These are the neocons that most Democrats in this country thought they voted out of office in 2006 and 2008. And they are still here. They never left.
Right. Yeah, that's such an important point. And yeah, this listenership does know. We've played those clips many times on the show and have been trying to focus on that. But yeah, that sure is a hell of a way to wrap this thing up. Backing outright fascists, outright, as my friend, I'm a broken record on this show at this point, but my friend Sheldon Richmond and I were joking that anybody with SS lightning bolts is not afraid that you're going to mistake them for a Nazi. They really are a Nazi. That's why they got the damn lightning bolts. It's about as simple as that. There is no alternative explanation.
Right.
You know.
So why doesn't Nuland put on one of those outfits?
It would be fitting. You know, her and her brother-in-law, Fat Neck Fred. Maybe they could go reinvade Iraq.
Yep. Frederick and Robert Kagan.
Yeah,
yep.
and Kimberly, too. Boy. All right, we're out of time. Thank you so much for your time. Nicholas J.S. Davies, everybody. Appreciate it.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Salon.com and alternet.org. We'll be right back with Gareth Porter in just a sec. Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Oh, man, for a second there, I thought he wasn't going to answer. I imagine he was running for the phone. I think I got it right. It's Gareth Porter the Great. Welcome back to the show. Gareth, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks, Scott. Glad to be back again.
Good deal. Appreciate you joining us. Everybody, you know Gareth. He's an independent historian and journalist. Writes primarily for Interpress Service at ipsnews.net. ipsnews.net. And also for truthout.org. He's the author of Perils of Dominance about Vietnam. And then the brand new book. Come on, go out and get the book or go to Amazon or whichever website you like best and get Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare by Gareth Porter. Manufactured Crisis by Gareth Porter. And so this will be part two in a series. Part one was for the KPFK show on Sunday. This is part two. I want to go through this book piece by piece. And today we're just talking chapter three, all about the politics inside Iran in determining their policies, you know, all from their point of view as best as Gareth has been able to uncover it. So chapter three is Iran's unknown nuclear politics. And the first real subject that you focus in on here is the revolutionary Islamic government post-1979 in Iran and their official position, or in fact the highest levels of their government, the supreme leader and his mullahs, their position on the making and use of chemical weapons during the Iran-Iraq war. Doesn't it go without saying that everybody knows that even if they're not making nukes, that the Iranians have chemical weapons, right, Gareth?
Well, it was certainly accepted as a fact for many, many years by virtually everybody who wrote about Iran and the weapons of mass destruction issue. Yeah, that definitely Iran had chemical weapons. We all know that. And, you know, there were various strands to that, but the main thing was the idea that the Iranians were guilty of having used chemical weapons in Halabja, which was the biggest, the most serious use of chemical weapons in contemporary history, basically. That is a Kurdish city, small Kurdish city in Iraq, in the Kurdish sector of Iraq, in 1988. And the reason that everyone thought that that was the case is that the Washington Post, Washington Post had a story in which the Defense Intelligence Agency officials report on Halabja and the use of chemical weapons was covered. And the story related that there was, in fact, a DIA report that showed that Iran had, in fact, used chemical weapons at Halabja, as well as the Iraqis using chemical weapons there. So that sort of entered into the literature and into the narrative, if you will, about Iran's WMD policy, until it turned out that that DIA report was, in fact, disinformation planted by the very people in the DIA who were working hand-in-hand, hand-in-glove, if you will, with the Iraqi Air Force to target the military targets of Iran for bombing. So they had a certain axe to grind, shall we say, with regard to the situation in Halabja. They wanted to cast doubt on the Iranian use of weapons, that is to say, to suggest the Iranians did use weapons, mm-hmm. so that Iraq wouldn't be singled out as the bad guy in regard to chemical weapons during that Iran-Iraq war. But in fact, there is no evidence that Iran ever used chemical weapons at all in the war. In fact, a book that was written many years later about this subject by the primary, well, he's now in, I think he's in charge of the crisis group, if I'm not mistaken, the International Crisis Group, shows that, in fact, there's, you know, the evidence is very clear that Iran did not use chemical weapons during that war at all. And so this initial indication, you know, turns out to be a major disinformation campaign, which has had a huge impact on the opinion in this country and throughout the world about this subject. But there's more to the story. I mean, you know, we don't want to go into too much detail, but, you know, there are other ways in which this story has been completely obscured. The truth has been obscured. And the truth is that Iran not only did not use chemical weapons, they did not produce chemical weapons. And the reason is that Ayatollah Khomeini...
Hold that. We do want to get into all that. And into all that detail. But I want to talk a little bit more about Halabja just for a second here.
Sure.
Wasn't it a clue when the DIA said, the DIA spin on this was that both Iran and Iraq had both attacked this village full of Kurdish civilians?
Yeah.
What the hell purpose would they have done that? It wasn't like the Hitler-Stalin agreeing to carve up Poland or something here. They're saying these two groups were at war with each other, but they both took a detour in time to go and massacre a bunch of Kurdish civilians.
Yeah, there was, you know, some complicated explanation, of course, for how that could have happened, which didn't make any sense, but don't expect that to be picked up. I mean,
and then one little ironic footnote here is that every peacenik's good friend, the late, great Jude Winiski, back when he was trying to stop the Iraq war, he bought the whole DIA narrative here. He was saying,
right,
Colin Powell, you're wrong in accusing Saddam Hussein of doing this because you have we have this DIA report from friends in the Reagan administration who said it was the Iranians. And I just thought that was kind of funny. And of course, the irony of the Reaganites back in power under George W. Bush being the ones to, you know, Colin Powell giving a big speech about Halabja and invoking this as a giant reason of one of their excuses for invading Iraq in 2003 when they were the ones who had helped Saddam, if not do that attack, at least helped him up to that attack and then afterwards again, as you write in your book, correct?
Yes, that's correct. I mean, you know, you're right that there's no specific evidence that the American officials in the DIA who were helping the targeting for the Iraqi Air Force were aware that Halabja was going to be attacked. On the other hand, Colonel Patrick Lang has been quoted as saying that they knew that it was, you know, that it was that they were using chemical weapons, and that they were not in favor of that. But on the other hand, they were not going to stop helping the Iraqi Air Force because of their use of chemical weapons. That, I mean,
and now I know you've used Patrick Lang as a source before. We were just talking about Admiral Fallon and his famous. Well, we weren't talking about this, but he's known for his famous quote about General Petraeus. Which I think you got that story from Patrick Lang. So did you, if I remember right, so did you talk to him for this book about this event?
No, I didn't because, I mean, you know, he is on the record basically confirming everything. This is not at this point, there's no real controversy about this. I mean, you know.
Other than just nobody's written it up this well before is all.
Well, I mean, in fact, I should have mentioned that Patrick Tyler, who wrote the original story, based on the DIA memorandum, later on recognized that he'd been taken. I mean, he'd been deceived.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote a book later on in which he did talk about the fact that that DIA memo was a falsehood and that, in fact, the people who wrote it were had a self-interest in casting blame on Iran along with Iraq for the Halabja use of chemical weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know...
And you do include that quote in the book.
I do. That's right.
just so people know, of the Washington Post reporter saying,
correct,
it turns out that wasn't really right.
Yeah, he's disowned his own story, saying that he was really taken in.
Okay, but so the importance of this, the reason we're getting all into this isn't because we're just trying to, you know, remind everybody what a bad guy Saddam was. The point is, this was a major, you know, so-called data point or whatever, I think is how you would put it, a fake piece of evidence of just what the Iranians were up to in their intent and their capability.
Right, and I'll just add very quickly, so people know, that there's another major data point, which is also a falsehood, and that is that a lot of sources, journalistic and otherwise, published sources, have suggested that Iran's representative to the Chemical Weapons Convention, later on, after the war, admitted that they had, in fact, produced chemical weapons. Well, in fact, if you read the statement, it's very clear he says the opposite. He says, we did not produce chemical weapons. He said, we tried to have a deterrent by having the capability, by announcing that we had the capability to produce chemical weapons, but we didn't do it. And instead of reporting that accurately, what has happened is that it's gone into the literature again that Iran admitted having produced chemical weapons. So, I mean, it's just an astonishing falsification of history.
Well, and you trace that to a dissident group, right, that had been banished by the Ayatollah. That misquote.
No, that was a different one. That was a different bit of disinformation.
There's a few. It's hard to keep track for the layman.
Yeah. But this specific piece of disinformation, I believe, actually may have been primarily caused by an Israeli journalistic report on the speech made by the Iranian official to the Chemical Weapons Convention, and I think it was picked up by other sources who didn't carefully check what actually was said. And as a result, I think we've just had this snowballing effect of everybody jumping on board and saying, yeah, well, this is what happened. And most recently, of course, the Washington Post fact checker fell for that one, and I caught him at it, and I corrected it, and he actually admitted, to his credit, that, yes, he'd been wrong about that.
All right, and now, in 45 seconds, can you just tell us about, I mean, you say that there was a fatwa by the old Ayatollah from the revolution, Khomeini, but that it was secret. They had it inside the government, but they didn't publicize it to the world. Why not?
That's correct. They had a fatwa against chemical weapons. The Ayatollah Khomeini basically forbade the production or use of chemical weapons. And that was dispositive of the Iranian policy during the war. They were never able to produce them or use them. But you know, they did not want to publicize this because they were still hoping to have some kind of deterrent effect by talking about having the capability.
Gotcha. All right. Well, now hold it right there. We got to take this break. Always interrupting. Gareth Porter. He's the author of the new book, Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. And man, is it good. You ought to go and buy it and read it. And we'll be right back after this. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you can hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples and email me scott@scotthorton.org for more information. See you there. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. My guest is the great Gareth Porter. This will be part two of our series about his brand new book, Manufactured Crisis, The Untold History of the Iran Nuclear Program. And so we're talking about the fatwa against the production of chemical weapons. And Gareth, you're saying they never did produce chemical weapons at all, the Iranians, and they didn't because the supreme leader said not only don't do it, but he claimed it was a religious edict, this fatwa, that it would be un-Islamic to do so, and that's the law, simple as that.
Yeah, and it's interesting, I mean, even some of the statements that were made by senior Iranian officials during the Iran-Iraq war that were an effort to deter Iraq from continuing the constant barrage of chemical weapons attacks against Iranians, those statements actually, in some cases, did concede that there were Islamic prohibitions against the use of the weapons, or at least that there was a problem with Islam being in contradiction to chemical weapons. So clearly, you know, they were trying to balance some kind of deterrent effect with the effort to, I'm sorry, with the prohibition against the weapons, but they were always hampered in that regard by the fact that they knew that they couldn't use them, and apparently they couldn't completely hide that fact either. So right. It was alluded to without really highlighting it, is the way I would put it.
Right. Okay, here's my thing. I don't really take much interest in what holy men have to say most of the time, and I hate politicians. I hate all of them especially, and they're all liars. I condemn them all. They're all guilty beyond a shadow of a doubt. And there's really no way for any of them, to prove their innocence to me. They're the most horrible people in the world, each and every politician in the world. And so a holy man politician comes out and says, well, I say it's against the law, the Islamic law, religious law, to make nuclear weapons. That just screams to me, that guy's making nuclear weapons, or else why would he say such a thing? So why should I believe that these people mean what they say at all, Gareth? Americans.
You know, I think the point here is that you've got a situation where you have to account for the evidence. And the evidence in this case is very clear that no one has been able to come up with any real evidence that Iran used chemical weapons during the Iran-Iraq war. And the fact is that Iran had a chemical sector that was, if anything, far more advanced than that of Iraq during the 1980s. So you can't argue really credibly that Iran simply was incapable of doing it. I mean, that just doesn't make sense. Nobody is going to be able to make the argument that Iran was prevented from having chemical weapons by its inability to create them. They had the scientific knowledge, they had the technical capability. There's no question about that. So you're left with the necessity to explain this failure to use chemical weapons, and there is an explanation that is consistent, that is credible, and which no one has thus far been able to effectively rebut. And that is that it was indeed a Shia jurisprudence reason. That is that chemical weapons were regarded as illicit in Islam. And obviously, you know, Western intelligence and Western political elites and intelligence officials have been reluctant to accept that. And I can tell you that I've never found anybody in the among the intelligence people that I've talked to who would say that they credited that idea. There's universal skepticism towards that, towards the idea that religion could have actually affected the military policy of Iran on such an issue. I mean, it's just so foreign to Western analysts that it's very, very difficult, if not impossible, to believe. But I do, in fact, think that is the that is what one is forced to accept if you actually deal honestly with the evidence. Mm.
And then the same thing for both Ayatollahs and for all nuclear weapons, too, that you're saying, you even say in there, whatever nuclear weapons research may have taken place in the late 1990s or early 2000s, before Rouhani got the file and started dealing with the E3, that those were rogue, unauthorized operations. Are you so certain that wasn't the Ayatollah, you know, had some guys working on a thing on the side there?
Well, I mean, I think, I do think that the government of Iran had a clear policy which was based on the idea that nuclear weapons were both illicit and unwise for Iran. I mean, I think that going back to Rafsanjani and particularly to Khatami, President Khatami, with of course Ali Khamenei president in between, that there was a consistent policy that Iran is not interested in nuclear weapons, that this is forbidden because it's weapons of mass destruction. There's plenty of statements to that effect, and arguments that were made that are quite credible, talking about how, you know, it would be crazy for us to, well, not crazy, but it would be unwise for us to think that nuclear weapons would assist our country in being more more secure. In fact, it would have the opposite effect. So a lot of different kinds of evidence converge to suggest that there was a policy in line with the idea that weapons of mass destruction are illicit under Islam, but also consistent with the sort of strategic viewpoint of the Iranian nuclear and sort of foreign policy elite. Not the nuclear elite, I take that back. I meant the strategic and foreign policy elite. And of course, the number one theorist in that elite, the number one specialist in that elite, was one Hassan Rouhani, who was the secretary of the Supreme National Security Council under Rafsanjani and under Khamenei, both. He was under President Rafsanjani, but under the Supreme Leader Khamenei from 1989 on. And I think that it's not only credible, it is difficult not to to believe that Hassan Rouhani was fully in line with that policy, that nuclear weapons are illegal as well as unwise for Iran. Now, I mean, I think that there was a debate going on, and I talk about this in the book, that there was a debate going on which was about whether having a capability, a nuclear capability, meant that they should know how to make nuclear weapons, or whether it simply meant that they should have the capability to enrich uranium. And I think some of the people in the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, and in the military research organizations, which had a self-interest in, you know, basically advancing their knowledge of nuclear weapons, wanted to go ahead and start studying, you know, this whole subject. So there's no doubt that there was that conflict going on. But, you know, I don't see the evidence here that there was ever a change in policy. I think the policy never changed, that Iran is not going to have a nuclear weapon. And so I think that whatever research was going on in the late 1990s and 2000 to 2003 was research that could not be considered a nuclear weapons program. I think that it was something that was being done which was not expected to result in a nuclear weapon.
Mm. All right, now, so be forgiving of the Hawks for a minute here. They're so suspicious, Gareth, and it sure does seem like the Iranian government has been absolutely hell-bent on overcoming, call it, American paranoia. Even if we concede, hey, the Americans are paranoid in the first place. The Iranians, boy, they seem hell-bent on pursuing nuclear technology no matter what. And why, if it's just to produce electricity? Don't you know they're sitting on a sea of oil over there?
Right. This is, of course, the single biggest argument, most widely shared, I would say, argument for believing that Iran must essentially be pursuing nuclear weapons, must have been pursuing weapons from the beginning. That is to say, using the civilian nuclear program as a cover for a nuclear weapons program. And I mean, I think there are a couple of points that have to be considered in response to that very popular, very widespread argument. The first is that, in fact, it is not the fact, it is not factual to say that Iran has no interest in a non-petroleum-based power program, because there is a very strong economic argument, which was made explicit during the Shah's regime, that ultimately the oil is going to run out. At that point, Iran would have to have nuclear power, and in the meantime, Iran needs to be able to sell as much of its petroleum resources as possible on the international market, which means that it needs to reduce its domestic consumption, and in order to do that, it needs to have a nuclear power program. So there is an economic rationale for this.
Yeah, just basic opportunity costs. After all, there's not much of an international market for uranium, but you can sell the hell out of oil if you want some money.
Well, yeah, and I think that the idea is often, the argument is often made that Iran flares off more power in their oil fields every year than they could possibly make up for with investment in nuclear power. I don't know if that's really true, but even if it is true, that does not dispose of the issue at all, because there are structural reasons why Iran has a very inefficient oil and gas industry, and that is because they have been unable to modernize those. They've been unable to get the technology and capital to invest in the necessary modernization of their oil and gas industries, and that's why it's so inefficient. That's one reason why it's inefficient. The other reason why it's inefficient is that Iran is in fact a statist economy. It's fundamentally a statist economy by its ideology, and therefore it's going to be inefficient. It's going to have widespread subsidies, and they've recognized the subsidies are damaging to their economic prospects, and so they're trying to do something about it. But the fact is that they run their economy in a way that makes it very difficult to pursue the kind of strategy that is being suggested would be rational for them to pursue by their critics.
All right, now I'm keeping you a little bit over time here, Gareth, just to wrap up chapter 3 here, if we can. Can you talk to us a little bit here about this latent deterrence and it's sort of like a lowercase mutually assured destruction, right?
Well, I mean, the idea of latent deterrence, it can have different meanings. But in this case, I think the notion that the Iranian theorists had from the beginning of their intention to enrich uranium was that the knowledge of how to enrich uranium and the demonstrated capability to do it by itself would have a deterrent effect. It was not necessary for Iran to have a nuclear weapon or to have a nuclear weapons program in order to have a certain, as they put it, latent deterrent effect from a nuclear program. And I think they're right. And I point out in the book that the former head of the CIA under Bush had publicly stated that that there were discussions within the Bush administration about the possibility of using military force against Iran, and they decided that they'd better not do that because it would have the effect of causing Iran to actually speed up the nuclear program that they already had and make it more likely that they would have nuclear weapons. And that's exactly the kind of latent deterrent effect that the Iranians had in mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, Gordon Prather used to joke about how they would say, you know, even if we bomb them, we're not sure if we know where all the sites are. And he would snicker and say, yeah, that's because there are none, you big dummy. But the point being that as long as they're deluding themselves in that way, it works. The fact that they know how to make a centrifuge and spin it, in a sense, is enough to put off invasion indefinitely.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that that's true. It's certainly one of the factors. I'm not saying it's the only factor that deters or discourages, shall we say, a U.S. and Israeli attack on Iran. But I think it is perhaps the single most important one.
Yeah, could be. And of course, what's funny here is that, and I don't know if we want to get too far into this part of it in this part of the interview, but might as well a little bit here about to bring up the golden offer, which was a story that you broke about the attempt of the Iranians in 2003 to make a grand bargain type offer to the Bush administration.
Right.
And of course, the story told by Flint Leverett and Hillary Mann Leverett, especially. But your article was a burnt offering in the American Prospect, if anybody wants to look at that. And this was their offer to negotiate on just about everything, including every aspect of their nuclear program, they said. And this is when they hadn't done a thing but bench-level tests yet, right? I think you say in the book that they had installed a few centrifuges at Natanz, but I don't think they were even spinning until 2005, right? Because that was when they took the BBC on a tour of the place, and it was just a big underground, big empty underground warehouse, right?
That's right. I mean, they were not actually doing any enrichment. They did not do anything until they started preparing for enrichment in 2005, mm-hmm. late 2005. So
if they have a latent deterrent now, it was a shadow of a latent deterrent back when they offered to give up everything. If we would only respect their sovereignty the slightest bit, basically.
Well, right. But, of course, I mean, they were interested in once they began to accumulate enriched uranium, low-enriched uranium, I think they viewed that as a very strong symbolic indication that Iran had achieved, the status of a nuclear power. I mean, in fact, Ahmadinejad in 2005... 2006, I guess I should say, publicly declared that Iran had joined the nuclear club. Iran was now a nuclear power because they had the ability to enrich uranium. And you know, the untold or the unspoken, I should say, the unspoken message in that way of talking about it, I think, was latent deterrence.
Right. All right. Now, well, you do talk a little bit about the attempted uranium swap deal in 2009 there at the end of Chapter 3. But I got to admit, I was just scanning that during the break, and I'm not sure if I really caught the gist of your point that you were making there. You were just citing that as an example of their willingness or of their using 20% enrichment as a bargaining chip, I guess.
Well, that was
one of the
negotiations. Points, definitely.
Say that last part again.
There was a lot of talk in 2010 about the fact that Iran was now threatening, you know, to enrich 20% uranium, that it was saying that some people argued that Iran was wanting to enrich 20% uranium and that it wouldn't do any good to have the fuel swap because it didn't settle the 20% uranium enrichment issue. But in fact, I quote, I believe it's Salehi, at that point, saying that that Iran was prepared to stop the 20% enrichment of uranium if the United States was prepared to go ahead with the fuel swap and to provide the fuel that it would need for the Tehran Research Reactor. I think that's a very weak, unsubstantiated argument that was being made against going ahead on terms that involved some compromise with Iran, which was a compromise that was really simply, more than anything else, recognizing Iran's need to be able to say, you know, that they weren't just totally caving in to the American demands. That they wanted to have assurances that they would get something back in return quickly, rather than having to wait a year or more.
Mm-hmm. Well, and as you talk about in Chapter 1 and/or Chapter 2, the French had already ripped the Iranians off on some uranium from a deal left over back from the 1970s. So they had a very specific reason to doubt the French.
It's not inconceivable that they really did distrust the French after that episode, and that it was not simply sort of a strategic use of that argument, although it was obviously, it could be used as an argument to try to exclude the French, who at that point, by the way, were taking a very pro-Israeli position on the whole nuclear issue. So they had very good reason not to want the French to be involved anyway.
Yeah, and then don't I have it right, and we're getting out of chapter three here now, but don't I have it right that Obama had specifically asked the Brazilians and the Turks starting in 2010 or the very end of 2009 to basically try again on the deal that had fallen apart in October of 2009? And and then they worked it out, and then he told them thanks but no thanks?
Yes, and this is a very interesting and still quite not quite explained episode in the annals of U.S. Diplomacy toward Iran. It appears to me that the Obama administration's senior officials, including the president himself, were so convinced that Iran was not going to negotiate something with them that they were prepared to encourage the Brazilians and the Turks to go ahead and try to get the Iranians to go along with this proposal. And of course, they were wrong about that. The Iranians were willing to do so with some degree of compromise. And so I think what the Obama administration was planning on was that this would sort of nail down the case that they were planning to make, that Iran was not interested in diplomacy and that there was now time for sanctions. And I think that they were a bit nonplussed when the Iranians went along. I mean, they were more than a bit nonplussed when the Iranians did agree, and then they had to quickly change signals.
Right. We will not accept your acceptance of our demands.
Right.
Okay. All right. Well, I guess that's a good place to stop this interview, too, before everybody gets bored and changes the channel anyway. So we'll be back tomorrow, I hope. You pick 3:30, 4, or 4:30 Eastern Time, Gareth, for Chapter 4 and or 5.
We can do the same thing.
All right. Good deal. It'll be part 3 of our continuing series with Gareth Porter about his brand-new book, Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. Thanks so much for your time, Gareth. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me again, Scott.
All right, see you tomorrow.